Thanks for listening to the Frontiers podcast. If you have a moment before we start, please rate and follow this podcast. It makes a huge difference. The more of you that do this, the more people get to listen. And the more people that get to listen, the bigger platform I'm building for academics to share their research. Thanks so much. Hi there, you're listening to Frontiers, the podcast that explores cutting-edge research from the world's best scientists. I'm Ian Hallett, and here's what's coming up today.
What are the common misconceptions of immigration?
There's a limited number of jobs to go around, and if immigrants come, they're going to take a job, and that job could otherwise be done by somebody who was already living here.
Where should we be concerned about today's labour market?
We've created a labour market where it's too easy to create insecure jobs which are vulnerable to exploitation.
So let's move on to technology.
What artificial intelligence as an augmentation to people working does is it helps people who are lower or average skilled get better without helping people who are very good at what they do.
That was Professor Jonathan Portis of King's College London. Professor Portis has previously served as Chief Economist at the Department of Work and Pensions, and he's also Chief Economist at the Cabinet Office. He's one of the UK's leading economists, and he demystifies immigration for us and its impact on the economy, the impact on jobs, and whether or not it is a good thing in the long run. It's a really rich conversation. I think you're going to love it. So now I'm going to hand you over to Professor Jonathan Portis. Professor Portis, thanks so much for joining me today.
Good morning.
Could we start by just giving us a flavour of the research that you do and the areas that you focus your efforts on?
Well, my primary research interest is the economics of immigration and particularly immigration to the UK. I would say I've probably branched out over the years from just concentrating on the economic impacts to looking a little wider at some of the broader social impacts of migration. I'm also interested in particular in the welfare and benefit systems, how the interaction of labor markets and the benefit system, particularly for people who are lower paid or disabled at the lower end of the labor market. And then more broadly, I'm part of a research network that looks at, in particular, Brexit and its aftermath and the impacts of Brexit on UK economy and politics more broadly.
Great, thank you. So immigration is a relatively provocative topic for some people. So the media has a particular perspective on it. Different politicians have a particular perspective on it. But I'd like to use this conversation, if we could, to really delve into the economic impacts of immigration, the benefits of it, and the costs of it. So what are the common misconceptions of immigration on a country's economy?
I think there are a number. The most obvious and the one that economists tend to focus on is the lump of labor fallacy. The idea that immigrants take our jobs in the sense that there's a limited number of jobs to go round in a country's economy. And if immigrants come, they're going to take a job, and that job could otherwise be done by somebody who was already living here. And this is a fallacy in quite a subtle way, in the sense that, of course, it is true in some sense that if an immigrant takes a job, then that job is not available for someone else. The point is not that at an individual level, immigrants don't take jobs that would in principle be available for people who already live here. The point is rather that immigration doesn't just affect the one side of the labor market, the supply of people who can do jobs. It also affects the demand side of the labor market, the amount of demand in the economy as a whole, and hence, indirectly, the number of jobs in the whole economy. So while it's correct that an immigrant may take a job, it is also the fact that an immigrant may create a job, because the demand generated by that immigrant in the economy through the wages that she or he earns and the amount that she or he spends is also going to affect the demand side and hence the number of jobs in the whole economy. So for most economists, the sort of starting point, the baseline assumption is that immigration has a neutral effect, at least in the long run, on employment, the employment prospects of other people, because it demands both demand and supply. Whereas there's a common misconception that migrants are overall taking jobs that could otherwise be done by natives. It's also worth noting from the other end of the spectrum, as it were, that this misconception can, in principle, operate in reverse and is often does operate in reverse by people who are on the pro-immigration side of the argument. So when people say we need immigrants to fill the vacancies in our economy, well, again, that may be true in a certain sense in the short term. But overall, there's no reason in particular to believe that having more immigrants will reduce the number of vacancies in the economy over the long term, because once again, immigrants will take jobs and fill vacancies, but they'll also help create them by adding to demand in the economy.
So that's really interesting. So that's a narrative that you don't hear often in popular press, in popular media, and the politicians. So why is it that influential leaders of this organization, of this country, use immigration as a tool to provoke a particular political position about it being bad? If the economists say, if the economic argument is actually it's neutral or possibly good over the long run?
Well, I think there's that question of how immigration plays into the political debate is one that is very context and time dependent and depends on, the interests of politicians and how the wider political debate is going at any one time. What I do think is often common, however, is that immigration tends to be used as a scapegoat for wider economic issues and for problems that either are more difficult, quote, to solve, quote unquote, or work politicians don't want to solve. So, for example, in the early 2010s in the UK, I do not think that David Cameron and George Osborne, then the Prime Minister and Chancellor, particularly believed that immigration was an economic negative. In fact, I am sure that George Osborne's views on immigration were not that different from mine. However, it was a very useful narrative at that time for the government to be able to say, well, some of the problems we're having, some of the economic problems we're having then, those are not the fault of our economic policies more generally. It's rather that there's too much immigration. That's what's driving the problems, not actually the policies of austerity and fiscal consolidation, which were implementing that they were implementing in government in the time. So that's it, immigration as a sort of as a scapegoat or distraction technique. On other occasions, and this goes into the sort of wider social questions, I think certainly in recent decades, politicians have, there is a view among some politicians that actually their electorate is anti-immigration, but they don't want, for reasons which are both bad and good, to address some of the deeper social or cultural motives that, at least for some people, underlie opposition to immigration. And hence, talking about the economic impacts is a somewhat sort of safer way of talking about those issues. And as I say, you can imagine both good and bad motives in principle for doing that. And you certainly saw some of that during the Brexit debate in the UK.
Well, it sounds like these narratives can lead to outcomes like Brexit, which may not necessarily, I'm not going to have a discussion here about whether Brexit was a good idea or a bad idea, but some say it was a very bad economic outcome. But a lot of the narrative behind it was about immigration, actually, and there's obviously sovereignty there as well. But that was a lot of the reason why many people voted for Brexit, was trying to stem the immigration flows into this country.
That's right. And I think it's very important when talking about both Brexit and immigration to recognize that people who are anti-immigration or people who are voting for Brexit are not monolithic. And there is it's not the case that everyone who voted for Brexit or everyone who thinks immigration should be reduced is a racist or a xenophobe, and that was their motivation. There were a whole, for example, when it comes to looking at anti-immigration motives, some people generally erroneously, but honestly, genuinely believe in some of the economic narratives that I think are broadly false, that immigrants take our jobs or push down wages by a lot or consume public services in a way that means there's less for the rest of us. Others are indeed racist or xenophobic. Others, particularly in the context of the Brexit debate, aren't necessarily anti-immigration per se, but thought that we should have a different system or a different means of control, and in particular, that EU membership meant that we had less control over sovereignty over our own immigration policy. And those motivations are quite different and disparate. So I think it's very much a mistake to label people who are either think that immigration should be reduced or who voted for Brexit as necessarily being racist or xenophobe. Some of them are, but there's quite a variety of different motives, and it's important to try and understand those different strands of the argument. And I think going back to what I said originally, this is why, I originally, approached immigration very much from a sort of fairly narrowly economic point of view. But the more I talk about it and the more I teach it, I recognize that you have to introduce different perspectives in looking at the issue.
It's interesting. I play golf on the weekends, and some people I play with run companies, and some people I play with are the local plumber. And it was very clear that the local plumber believed that immigration was taking his business away, as without question. And it was new skills coming into the marketplace. It were possibly lower prices as well. And you can't have a conversation with them about, isn't that just increased competition? And yes, of course, maybe immigration is the reason for the increased competition, but it could have been lots of other things that could have driven your competitive landscape. So irrespective of the argument you might want to make, it's very difficult to convince somebody that sees that as their reality, that this isn't the cause to the effect that they're experiencing.
That's right. And of course, that we shouldn't be naive about this. That reality may actually be correct for that individual. As you say, greater competition in general is good for the economy, and in general is good for the country as a whole, and hence the individuals in it. You and I gain from having cheaper and possibly better or more qualified plumbers, but individual plumbers may indeed lose out. And in that sense, of course, immigration is like free trade. We know that in general, freer trade is likely to be a significant economic benefit to the country as a whole and to the average worker and consumer. But we also know that individual groups of workers may lose out in the short term, and that can be true of immigration. Of course, it's not as simple as that. That greater competition is necessarily bad for people. So, for example, in my own field, economics, immigration is probably a much bigger factor than it is in, say, plumbing. I would guess that the proportion of UK-based economists who are not of UK origin is even greater than the proportion of substantially greater than the proportion of UK-based plumbers who are not of UK origin. So in a direct competition sense, I am more effective than your plumber, right? But I would not say that I lose out from having immigrants who come to the UK to do economics, despite the fact that And going back to what I was saying before, I've no doubt, I know as a matter of fact that there have been occasions when I've applied for a job and lost out to somebody who was not British born. So in the short term, maybe I lose from that competition, but in the longer term, I probably benefit from the positive impact of non-UK born economists on the quality and quantity of UK economics as a whole. That competition leads to the sector being bigger, more interesting, and to be quite honest, better paid than it otherwise would have been. So the sort of short term and the longer term impacts can often be quite different.
Absolutely. So I'm going to make a number of links here, and please point out if the links are false or incorrect. So I think it's important to help understand the dynamics of a population. So my understanding is that the economic progress of a country is driven in part by the number of people in the country, clearly, and their productivity as well. So this is where the immigration conversation comes in. So when you have countries like the UK, and more notably like Korea or Japan, where the birth rates are very, very low, birth rates per woman are below the amount needed in order to sustain the population at a level, point to the point that some people are saying that population collapse is a real long-term problem for a lot of developed economies. Is immigration the answer to that type of problem? Because obviously there's population growth in lots of other countries where they're having two or three or four births per women. So isn't the kind of the logical conclusion that we're going to have to accept immigration over the long run in any event if we want to sustain the economic standards of the country?
I think the answer is yes and no, in the sense that that demographic challenge and change that's happening in most advanced economies, particularly as you say, some East Asian economies, but increasingly in European economies, does mean that more immigration is both necessary and desirable, and inevitable. The sheer, you know, the labor market pressures that you will see in advanced economies mean that there will be very strong economic and political pressures to see higher levels of immigration. That will be beneficial. It will help deal with some of the issues that result from that demographic transition. But I would say that immigration, going back to what you say that right at the beginning, immigration is not the answer. And what do I mean by that? I mean that two things, I think. First of all, that it's unlikely to be politically or economically sustainable simply to deal with declining birth rates by having higher immigration. I think that's going to be politically quite difficult to manage, economically quite difficult to manage in terms of how you integrate people into the labor market. But more broadly, I also think that it's not the answer in the sense that if you have a country where families, especially women, do not want to or do not feel able to have children in the prevailing economic and social environment, that's the sort of fundamental social problem that you actually need to deal with. And immigration doesn't help you there, right? The problem in Korea is that the nature of gender relations and gender politics, the nature of labor markets, and the nature of the way that the education system works make having children difficult, painful, and expensive, particularly for younger women. That is a very bad thing. And you actually need to wake up to that and say, what are we as a society going to do to reduce to ensure that the nature of gender relations in this country doesn't operate that way, to ensure that the education system doesn't operate that way. Similarly, in the UK, our problems are not as bad, but fertility has been falling quite sharply. We have a situation where lots of young people feel that the nature of the housing market in particular, the nature of the labor market and tax systems, is such that they cannot have as many children or, as they would in an ideal world want to. And that's why fertility is falling. And that's a problem. That's society's not working well, particularly for younger families or younger couples. And we need to do something about it. So immigration is, in my view, both necessary and desirable to as a consequence of that fall in fertility, and will help to ease the demographic transitions as we age. But that doesn't mean that we don't need to tackle the underlying structures that make it harder for people to have children, because if we don't, we're not going to have the sort of society that I think we want. And immigration is not the answer to that.
Absolutely. So the narrative today, though, is, and in quite a lot of, not just the UK, but quite a lot of other countries, is that immigration is something to be managed. It's something that isn't desirable, even though logically, and I obviously acknowledge the point that saying it's not the solution, but it is necessary to some of the demographic changes that we're going to experience in the future. So how does the shift, how does the narrative change between it being a perceived undesirable thing, which is a narrative in many countries today, to a, this is something that actually we need to accept and embrace alongside other economic and social reforms?
I think that it is actually quite reasonable to say that immigration needs to be managed. I don't think anyone is, that there is any significant political constituency sort of saying that the UK should unilaterally adopt or any advanced economy should unilaterally adopt a regime of open borders or of free, widespread free movement with the entire world, or even a large proportion of it. So immigration has to be managed. And I think, to be fair, the debate, at least in the UK, the debate in the UK is not perhaps as bad as you might think. While the polls show that most people say in principle that they want to see immigration reduced, there is still a very large majority of people who think that some immigration is necessary. And when you look at individual categories of people, if you ask people, should we permit people to come here to work in the health service or in social care, they say yes. Should we permit people to come here to study? They say yes. Should we permit people to come here in areas where there are shortages of domestic skills? They tend to say yes. So public attitudes are more nuanced. What people do want, I think, is the sense that immigration is managed and controlled. And I think this is the problem for those people who want a generally open, more open or more liberal policy, is that that perception of control and management is very much undermined by irregular migration of the sort we've seen, in particular people coming across the channel to seek asylum or refugee status, or indeed other forms of irregular migration. And people then say, well, it's not being managed or controlled. We need to do something about it. And they're not completely wrong in that. Obviously, that situation is highly undesirable. But it's what needs to be conveyed is that the answer to that isn't and cannot be punitive measures that somehow stop all irregular migration ever, because that is not realistic. That's not how it works. You can't just say, we are going to become a fortress. We're going to let in exactly the people we want in exactly the way we want, because that form of management is not realistic. So trying to convey to people that, yes, the system should be managed and controlled overall, and yes, it is managed and controlled overall, but that doesn't mean that we can control exactly who comes here, the exact numbers, the exact jobs that they're going to do. Actually, that's not the way an open economy or an open society works. We need a more pragmatic approach to managing migration that recognizes that lots of people are going to want to come. We need lots of people. We need a system that deals with them fairly and that is overall managed and controlled, but recognizes that actually in an open society, in an economy, that's not going to be, you know, that's not going to work perfectly all the way, all the time, any more than it does in any other fields of economic management.
And how are we managing it today? Is the system working?
I think in the UK, the system's actually working rather better than in many respects, somewhat better than I and others expected immediately after the Brexit vote. Indeed, migration to the UK has been higher overall in the last couple of years than perhaps in any other time in recorded history. So we certainly haven't become a closed economy or a closed country after Brexit. We have a system where we have people are allowed to come here to do particular jobs at particular skill or salary levels. That has its positives and its negatives relative to the system that we had before Brexit, where we had free movement with Europe and a very restrictive system with the rest of the world. But it's a system which in some sense is working reasonably well at the moment for the UK labour market. We also have a system where lots of people come here to study, and some of them at least are able to stay on at least for a few years after studying and work in the UK. Again, that system is not working perfectly, but it's probably not badly attuned to the UK labour market. We have also a system where very high vacancy rates in the NHS and social care sectors have meant that an extremely large number of people have come to work in those sectors. Now, there are pluses and minuses in that, and in particular, there's clearly some exploitation and abuse in the social care sector, because that sector is a sector that's underfunded and pays very low wages. I think, actually, that's at the moment a serious failure of government policy. So I think the current picture is mixed, but on the whole, actually, I don't think the system we have is working too badly. There is a problem with public perceptions, and there's clearly a problem with irregular migration, in particular people are coming across the channel, which is both dangerous and undesirable and contributes to a general feeling among large parts of the population that the system is in some sense out of control. I don't think it is out of control. The numbers coming across are relatively small, but that perception is clearly dangerous, and it would clearly be much better if we had a refugee and asylum system where those flows were better managed.
You mentioned labour markets. I'd like to move our conversation on to the state of today's labour markets. So where should we be concerned about today's labour market in its totality? You mentioned the healthcare sector as a particular example. It'd be great to build on that and any other areas where we should be particularly concerned about the state of the labour market.
Well, I think the UK labour market, as it evolved in the especially in the 90s and 2000s, was one that was relatively lightly regulated, quite flexible, quite good at creating jobs, especially for people at the lower end of the labour market. And had relatively low unemployment. And that worked quite well in some respects for a couple of decades. I think what we've seen, however, is, and I think there's something of a consensus among labor market economists about this, is that this has gone too far in some sense, in the sense that we've created a labor market where it's too easy to create relatively insecure jobs, which are vulnerable to exploitation, and where people are not particularly necessarily happy with the way they are treated, with the way that the management worker relationships work, with the nature of their contracts, and so on. So the gig economy, broadly defined, which works well for some people in some contexts. So, you know, I function as part of the gig economy myself when I do consulting work, and that works very well for me. I'm very well paid, and that flexibility is a benefit to me. But it doesn't work all the time, particularly at the lower end of the labor market. That, in turn, has meant that particularly the UK has had a long-standing problem with large numbers of people outside of the labor market because of sickness, disability, and ill health. And that's become an even greater problem since the pandemic. So we have relatively low unemployment. We still have high levels of vacancies in some sectors. But at the same time, we've seen a rapidly growing number of people who are outside the labor market because they are sick or disabled. And we have a benefit system which actually, because it treats unemployed people very badly, we pay very, very low levels of unemployment benefit, and we have extremely stringent conditions on people who pay to pay unemployment benefit. That has tended to force people off unemployment benefit into the disability benefit system, from which it's very difficult to give them the help and support they need to get back into the labor market. So I think that nexus of the problems around insecure and sort of overpressured work, and the nature of our benefit system has contributed to a position where lots of people are getting stuck, as it were, outside the labor market on sickness or disability benefits. We have no realistic strategy for getting them both healthier and happier and back into the labor market, into the sort of jobs that they would want to do.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So it would be great to understand the dynamics of play here, so to really understand what's going on. So on one hand, it sounds like over the last few years we've had relatively high or very high immigration, and we also seem to have low unemployment, and we also seem to have lots of vacancies in certain sectors. So as the labour market, as the people that are participating in the labour market, has that got smaller? Or has the demand for people been taken up in other sectors?
So participation rates overall in the UK, after doing quite well over most of the last 20 years, have fallen over the last few years. So the proportion of people who are, you know, of UK-born people, or indeed people who've been resident here a long time, who are actually in a job, has fallen, even as unemployment has remained at very low levels, because there's been an increase in the number who are inactive, neither in a job nor looking for work, and inactive because of sickness or disability. And that's particularly because of a number of people with mild or moderate mental health conditions. And as I said, I think that is to a significant extent driven by the fact that both by the fact that lots of jobs at the lower end of the labor market are quite stressful and demanding and not particularly good for people's life satisfaction or mental health. And also because the way we treat people who are unemployed, instead of trying to give them a decent amount of support while they get a job that suits them, we pay them very little and we treat them very badly. And hence, that's bad for their mental health. And it also tends to make it more likely that they're going to end up claiming a sickness or disability benefit rather than unemployment benefit. And if you do that, it's much more likely that you're going to come back into the labor market. There's also different dynamics in different sectors, of course. So, you know, there have been over the last couple of years lots and lots of jobs available in the care sector. And as a consequence, the government has allowed large numbers of people to come here under the care worker visa to work in those jobs, because it doesn't want the care system to collapse completely. I don't think, on the whole, that it is necessarily realistic to expect people who are currently on sickness or disability benefits to go from those benefits into the care sector, which is a difficult job, demanding both physically and psychologically. That doesn't mean there aren't jobs that people currently on sickness and disability benefits could do if they were given the right help and support, but it's probably going to be in other sectors.
Does that not create a more unequal society? Isn't the logical conclusion here, if you've got fewer people participating because of illness, and illness in its broadest sense, as you were describing, isn't that a more unequal society in the end?
Absolutely, there is absolutely no doubt that one of the impacts of this is greater inequality both in terms of income and wealth, but probably inequality in other social outcomes like well-being and life satisfaction. So this is, you know, this is in some sense the rise in sickness and disability, and in particular in mental health, is possibly the biggest single social problem facing the UK at the moment.
So let's move on to technology, which some say may create even greater inequalities as well, particularly as artificial intelligence has the capabilities to do tasks that people are currently employed to do. How concerned are you about that when you think about the labour market as a whole? Is that something that we should be very concerned about? Is it, how present is it? Is it, you know, soon or many, many years away? I mean, it's hard to predict, but I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
I think it's exceptionally difficult to predict. I would make two points. First of all, we do not know that just looking at the technology and its impacts on different types of people. So we don't know that yet. There's no doubt that technological change over the last 30 years has been what economists call skill biased. That is to say, it has, you know, reduced the incomes and labor market power of lower skilled people and helped those with higher skill levels. And that has contributed to a growth in inequality. We become more unequal because more skilled people have become better paid and lower skilled people have become worse paid in relative terms. That has driven an increase in inequality. And a lot of that, probably most of that, is due to technological change directly or indirectly. But, and this is the key point, that doesn't necessarily mean that the technological change we're seeing now will have the same effects. There, some economists with who are, work more directly on this area than I do, claim that at least so far, artificial intelligence may have the opposite impact, in that they claim that the evidence so far is that what artificial intelligence as an augmentation to people working does is it helps people who are lower or average skilled get better without helping people who are already very good at what they do, right? So presumably the intuition here is that, you know, if you're just the sort of average or below average person writing a report, artificial intelligence can bring you up to the average or even better than the average quite easily. Whereas if you're already very good at writing a report, artificial intelligence isn't going to help you to make it much better. And for what it's worth, I sort of get that impression from some of my students that the AI that we have now actually helps people who aren't terribly good at writing, but doesn't help those who are already quite good at it that much. So maybe actually artificial intelligence is an equalizer or a leveler. We don't, I would, however, you know, I don't want to be too optimistic here. These are very early days yet. This is just sort of experiments. It doesn't really, in my view, tell you that much about the wider social impacts. But we shouldn't assume that just because technology has driven inequality in the past, that it will necessarily in the future. That's the first point I would make. The second point, and probably the more important point in some sense, is that it's not just about technology. It's about power and economic structures. So while technology drove the rise in inequality over the last 30 years, that was the sort of the fundamental underlying driver. That rise in inequality was very much facilitated by changes in the nature of economic and political power, in particular the erosion of the trade unions in most of the private sector in most advanced economies, and the shifting of balance of power away from organized labor towards companies. That too drove inequality. And I think I and lots of, you know, making a broader point, I and lots of other economists who from, as it were, the economic mainstream, who tend to take a fairly sort of abstract view and say, well, look, this is all technology. You know, we were not terribly interested in this sort of class analysis or analysis of how changes in power structures impact, because it's all driven by the underlying economics and technology. I think many of us have come back towards more of what you might call, if you didn't want to offend us, if you wanted to offend us, a more Marxist influenced, at least, view. So, for example, there was a statement yesterday, just published just a few days ago, by Angus Deaton, the Nobel Prize winning economist, from the British born economist now in the US, saying that he'd come to realize that actually trade unions were probably a good thing rather than a bad thing because of their mitigating impact on inequality. And I think lots of us in the mainstream have swung back more towards that type of view. So look, that's a slight digression, but looking forward, I would say that the impact of AI on inequality and other broader social outcomes will be driven not just by the sort of neutral, you know, abstract question of what does the technology do, but who controls it, who owns it, how governments regulate it, and how, therefore, it is incorporated into our economy and society. So in that sense, I think not that we should be very worried or panicking, but we shouldn't treat this as some sort of neutral thing that will just happen. We should be thinking actively about how we collectively as a society want to regulate, control it, because that will determine what the impact is on inequality and all these other social outcomes that we care about.
So that's a really interesting angle on it around regulation and control. Because I think it's hard to, well, impossible, frankly, to regulate and control social media or regulate and control disinformation at large, because the internet is an open thing. So how would you as a government create policies around regulating and controlling something like artificial intelligence, which is ubiquitous and available cross-border?
I certainly don't think, you know, the answer is not going to be things like, you know, prohibiting things or seeking to license particular bits of software. As you say, that isn't going to work. I think the sort of analogy, though, is probably, you know, so looking again at sort of technology, we now have a situation in the UK and most advanced economies where very large tech firms, Amazon, Apple, and so on, capture very, very large shares of economic value. And that clearly results in greater inequality. By contrast, to some extent, at least, if if you ensure that some, at least, of the infrastructure is under national control, as is the case to some extent in India, so where you have a sort of national identity infrastructure built for other reasons, but where private sector or companies can build on, can add on, can build apps or, you know, gain access or allow access to the population, you can imagine there might be ways of the government not controlling what companies do, but providing some of the basic infrastructure through which companies access consumers in a way that democratizes and nationalizes it in a way which at the moment doesn't seem to be happening. I wish I knew the answer here, frankly, and I certainly don't. But I think we do need to think about how governments can prohibit or control what private companies do so much, but how there is some degree of collective or social control over the basic infrastructure, whatever that turns out to be.
Absolutely. I don't think anybody knows the answer right now. I think it's so early and so complicated. And the predictions are so varied as well in terms of what this new technology will actually do. It's frankly impossible to predict. I want to talk about the other big thing that's going on in the world. I mean, there are lots of big things going on in the world, but the other big thing is climate change. And there is evidently a very significant cost to the economy to shift from a carbon-based economy, which mostly economies around the world actually are, to a sustainable economy. So from an economic development perspective and from a policy perspective, How do governments go about transitioning when there's new costs to be incurred to shift an economy from one way to a dramatically different way? How would a government go about thinking about that transition, and how are we doing overall?
I mean, I think most economists across the spectrum would agree that the sort of the prerequisite is some degree, some directly or indirectly putting a price on carbon. That is to say, you need to give that basic economic incentive that means that the consumers of fossil fuels, directly or indirectly, pay for something extra to reflect the carbon emissions that are generated. That both that and that produces incentives to economize on the use of fossil fuels or carbon and to develop alternatives. So I think that sort of very basic economic principle that you start with getting the pricing right, or at least closer to right, is a sort of precondition. So I think that probably is pretty much common ground among all economists, from the, you know, the libertarian to the other end of the spectrum. I think where economists would legitimately differ is on where you go from there. There are economists who would say, well, look, that's all you need today. You just put a price on carbon. That'll solve everything, right? The market will sort everything else out. Because you'll have that incentive to save energy, and to develop forms of low carbon or no carbon energy.
So if you think about the conversation that we have had, we've covered immigration, we've covered the labor markets, we've covered technology, and we've touched on climate change. If you're an individual running a company, there's a lot going on. And, you know, in addition to all the other things that you would need to address as part of doing that role. So given that these are particularly transformative effects, destabilizing effects in some ways on organizations. So if you were advising a chief executive, a board of a meaningful company, what types of advice would you give to them to help them plan for and ensure that they are properly addressing and mitigating the risks of some of the things that we've talked about, and perhaps taking advantage of the opportunity should they arise?
I think it's the first thing I would say is you cannot forecast the future, and anybody who claims they know what's going to happen shouldn't be trusted, and that certainly applies to economists. And we all know the issues with economic forecasting. So you need to think about what are plausible scenarios. So I would say that you have to sort of sit down and think for your business, what are plausible scenarios over the next few years, both in terms of the sort of economic and technological trends, things like artificial intelligence and climate change, but also, unfortunately, one also has to, depending on the business, has to think about geopolitical trends. How would your business be positioned in the event of certain scenarios coming to fruition? And again, you don't do this because any one scenario is the most likely one. Because this sort of discipline of thinking of how you're resilient to different future paths is the best way to put yourself and your business in a position to respond to those. So I think that sort of scenario planning or risk management type exercise is the most important one you can do, remembering that you're not going to get the future right. You should and you shouldn't pretend you can, but you can think about how resilient your business is to different future paths.
Very clear, thank you. Do you have a key message or any further points you'd like to have listeners take away from this conversation?
I would say, going back to something I said earlier, that certainly as an economist, I've learned to be a bit more humble about my own profession or about what's going to happen in the future than I was perhaps 15 years ago, things and certainly economy seemed more stable, and economics on its own seemed a more useful discipline for analyzing what was likely to happen. I think you need that I've learned that economics is by no means the only thing. It's incredibly useful, but you need a wider range of perspectives, and you need to remember that the future is considerably more uncertain than we might have thought. And again, as I said, to think about how you, personally would react or fare under different possible scenarios, looking at it from a variety of different perspectives.
Thank you. This has been a rich, interesting conversation covering immigration, labor market, social policy, AI, climate change. I mean, I don't think many people would think that all of those things were necessarily connected, but the conversation has flowed, I think, very naturally towards that. So, Professor Portis, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for listening. To support this podcast, please follow us on whatever platform you're using. It makes a huge difference. Thank you again. Hope to see you next time.